Views and opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the staff or management of the Flavors of Northwest Arkansas podcast.
You can't do drugs before you come in and wait tables.
Yeah.
You need to staff for the business you want, not the business you have.
Right.
Because if you staff for the business you have, you're not going to increase it. You know, it's just you're not going to be able to keep up.
We had one of the barbers, because we used to be up the road, and he was like, can you guys, he would just come in and ask what we could make him for lunch. So I got to be creative, and since we're a small place, would just kind of make him whatever suited his palate, and a Frito pie was one of them.
Heck yeah.
Look at how many things you can do with four items. You can puree one of them, saute the other three, and then you have, you know, it's just so many combinations. Absolutely. It's unbelievable.
What food trucks are specifically really good for is incubating.
Without question.
And so that's we're really happy that we were able to do that, and that's exactly the way it worked for us. You know, we didn't know what we were doing when we started, but right. We were able to do it, just the two of us.
Welcome to the Flavors of Northwest Arkansas podcast.
I was pre-med in college first, then went to pre-pharmacy, then had a kid, and my wife was like, you want to go to culinary school?
Here's your host, John Engelman.
Is that breaking news?
That's breaking news.
Goodness.
Yeah. Some people know that we've been working towards that for a really long time.
Yes. There is breaking news on this week's episode. Welcome to the Flavors of Northwest Arkansas podcast, where we talk about the bustling food and beverage scene here in NWA. Today we head out to Conifer, of course, in Bentonville, and we talk to chef and owner Matt Cooper, who, by the way, is one of two Bentonville chefs to be named semifinalist for the James Beard Award for Best Chef in the South, the other being Rafael Rios at Yayo's. The recognition does not stop there for Matt, though, as Conifer was named one of the top new restaurants in the South last year by Southern Living magazine. And there's an interesting story as to how he found that out. The Arkansas native has lived all over the state and went to the Pacific Northwest for his culinary training. And from his work experiences coming up through the industry, he learned about running restaurants and, quite frankly, how not to treat people. He also tells us when he knew it was time to step out and open his own place. Strong relationships with the community and strong relationships with local farmers also help make Matt and Conifer what they are, which includes a very strong focus on sustainability. And as many know, Conifer is a gluten-free restaurant for several reasons, but most notably because good chefs taste their food. And Matt has celiac disease, which made it tough for him coming up through the business at restaurants that were not gluten-free, but he fought through. Also, hey, we debut a new segment this week that my father demanded I do. A little bit of a corny premise, but you actually may like it as, and I can't believe I'm saying this, I like it, and that's why I'm adding it. You'll see what that is. And oh yeah, there's that breaking news for Conifer, and you'll hear that here first. Well, most of you. And that's right here on the Flavors of Northwest Arkansas.
Teachers are dynamic leaders shaping a new generation. They bring a variety of perspectives from diverse backgrounds, innovating how they teach to prepare students for our fast-changing world. They're skilled experts discovering a universe of solutions, telling stories, inspiring, mentoring, connecting cultures, leading by example. Teaching is a journey that shapes lives. Are you ready? Explore teaching at teach.org, supported by the U.S. Department of Education and 1 million teachers of color.
Welcome back to the Flavors of Northwest Arkansas. We are on location at Conifer in Bentonville with Chef Matthew Cooper. Matthew, Matt, what's the best way?
Either way, Matthew, Matt, whatever
okay.
works.
I know most important to you guys is prep time. It's huge, so I thank you for taking some time out for me today.
Yeah, no problem. I appreciate your time very much.
Awesome. Well, congrats on the James Beard Award semifinalists for Best Chef of the South. I think most people listening are not real sure what the process is like. Did the James Beard folks like send shoppers and people to really kind of check it out, or do they even let you know?
So one thing I'd like to say first is we get a nomination for semifinalists. So the award is when the process is entirely done. Mm-hmm. So we're really grateful for the nomination to be a semifinalist. Like one of a few other, you know, plenty other chefs that have been nominated, about 15 or so, sure, in the South for Best Chef South. And the James Beard Foundation takes a lot of collective data based on a lot of different things. Honestly, from education to sustainability to how you're nurturing your people and your creativity and the difference you make in your community, all those things kind of play in a factor, and many, many more into the people that get chosen. So Rafael Rios has also been chosen. This is his fourth nomination for semifinalist, which is amazing for him and amazing for Bentonville. So these things, you know, all these wonderful things that happen only further, like, help our community develop and grow and nurture, you know, and give us the opportunities to, like, do all the things that we're pushing towards. So how the process works after the nominations for semifinalists come out is in between now and April 3rd, the James Beard Foundation will go through and review all of the selected nominees and probably go to the restaurants and do some things like that. And then out of those semifinalists, about five or six finalists, I do believe, will be chosen, and that will be announced on April 3rd. When that happens, those five people go to the award ceremony in June, and then the winner of the James Beard, the actual award, is given to the winner of those five finalists. So it's a pretty extensive process. That's why people are just so grateful and so happy when you just get a nomination, because, I mean, to be chosen out of so many people, I mean, obviously we think we do an amazing job and we're really trying and pushing, you know, harder and harder. We have very different, what I love about James Beard is that it focuses on so many different facets of the restaurant industry, from creativity to how sustainable you are to what and how you are in the community that you're in and what you do on a global scale. Like, you know, we try to be huge advocates on a global scale in any way that we can and stuff like that, you know. So we always joke around here, you know, I'm, you know, 70% humanitarian, 30% chef, you know. It's a joke, but it's true, because it's how our mentality goes with how we treat our people and why we opened the restaurant and how many people came together when I wanted to just break off from my last executive chef job and actually truly, you know, make a difference in the community and have that focus in our mantra and in our ethos and what we do and how we do it. And and that's why I think it's so nice to, for everyone, you know, to feel a little bit of the recognition and awareness from other people seeing what we do and the hard work we put into what we do.
Well, and I think it's big for Northwest Arkansas too, because has there been another time where there have been two semifinalists in this area?
Yeah, so I think at one point in time, Matt McClure, previously at the Hive, he's up in, sure, Vermont now, an amazing human, a good friend. He actually texted me this morning. He was up for it, I think eight times, and done just a really amazing job helping build Northwest Arkansas before he moved off. And you know, Bentonville, especially when I moved up here in 2015 to help open Rope Swing Hospitality Group. And then have since branched off, and now Conifer is my restaurant, the single owner restaurant, which is, you know, we'll get to in a minute probably. You know, there was some people here doing some really great things. Matt McClure was here, Rob Nelson was here, Tuscan Trotter. You had Luke and Molly about to open Oven and Tap or getting ready for that. And there were some kind of movers and shakers, but there wasn't that much going on. The movement was here, and there was a match lit, and it was starting to burn. But now it's just, I mean, the amount of change that we've seen since I've been here in almost 9 years. Yeah, that's right. 9 years has just been absolutely transformative.
Those years go fast.
It's just insane. Yeah, it's so crazy. And most of the people that have worked, you know, work with us now, like my general manager, I call her my partner, Hope, she's, you know, she started working with me at Old Press Room, like across the street. That was 9 years ago as a barista. Sure. And, you know, like that story is so unique to us too. Like, I have so many people here working in this restaurant with us that are a part of the shared vision, that have worked with us for years in this town and from other places. My chef de cuisine has been with me for 15 years. He's opened six restaurants with me. You know, he's one of the most amazing people I've ever met, you know.
Hope had asked me a second ago how long I'd been here, and I had to stop and think. 15 years goes fast.
Oh, wow.
Really quickly. Yeah. So Well, you know, the awards didn't stop there. Southern Living Magazine, we talked about that briefly, and it's you guys got one of the best new restaurants of 2023. You didn't even know about it.
Yeah, no, that's kind of the way things happen. We really stick to our four little walls, you know, and really focus on like how we're growing and making sure we're staying aligned with what we do. You know, it's hard enough to do that, and making sure that we're sticking with our ethos and like helping the community and benefiting the local farmers and still trying to stay creative and do all the things that we want to do. And I'm just kind of like that. I had a friend who was a good friend, who's a chef, who watches all that stuff. He's the one that texted me one morning, because I didn't know when the semifinals came out, because I just didn't think that we would have been on the radar. Because we just opened a year and a half ago. We would have been open 6 months when we started being reviewed, probably.
Sure.
So, I mean, when I step back and think about that, then I'm just so very proud of all the people that, and I've said that before, of all the people that chose to like give up what they were doing, come and support the vision of this restaurant, be a part of it, and help push this vision for Northwest Arkansas that we really want to push. And I think it's the vision of a lot of the people that live in this area, mm-hmm. and that's why it's been such a boom and so crazy and gotten so much growth. It's because people really, really care about what's happening in the daily lives and of the people here and in a lot of other places.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk about your professional journey. Where are you originally from?
I grew up in Arkansas. So my father was a Methodist minister, grandfather and great-grandfather were Methodist ministers in the state of Arkansas. So we moved around everywhere. My mother was a food technologist, and all my mother's side of the family were food technologists, Uncle Ben's, Rice and Foods, M&M Mars, things like that. My grandfather started the food technology program at Texas A&M and at Fayetteville. And so food science, and then like I like to call it humanitarianism, were kind of how I was raised. My mother grew up in Oregon as well, so I grew up all in Arkansas. Was pre-med in college first, then went to pre-pharmacy, then had a kid, and my wife was like, "You want to go to culinary school?" And so we went to culinary school. I'd been cooking before then, but went to culinary for about 6 or 7 years, cooking my way through college. Went to culinary school in 2007 in Portland, Oregon, where my mother was from.
Okay.
Kind of reconnected with the Pacific Northwest there. Lived there for about 7 years, trained all over that city and worked with some really amazing chefs, and really found my passion for what was already existing in me, the sustainability portion. And like, I worked for a local produce store, as well as being a chef during the daytime, or a sous chef of a restaurant on the waterfront there.
What a great area.
Yeah, it was amazing. And you know, just the mentality of, you know, the mentality of things that we did there still doesn't exist here today. And I think that gave me a unique opportunity to bring that perspective back. You know, it's the same story. We moved away, and I think there's so many people that have done that in this area, and you see such a flux. Like, you know, I would say, you know, 60% or 70% of the people that live in Bentonville are not from Bentonville. They come from very, very different, diverse places, and I think that's why Bentonville gains this unique perspective of not only evolution, but creativity and innovation and all the things that we all think about when we think about what Bentonville is. So that's kind of my journey in a thing. You know, when grew up in Arkansas, I lived in about 32 different places in my life, including Portland, Oregon and Austin, Texas, way back in the day. And then I moved back to Little Rock in 2010. And dove right into the community of Little Rock and built a few restaurants and worked there, and then got the opportunity in 2015 to come up here. And I lived in Rogers 20 something years ago, and I can tell you, I wanted to get out. And then when Rope Swing was kind of talking to me, I was like, you know, I just opened a restaurant in Little Rock. I don't really have time. I can't, you know, I want to give them a certain amount of time. It wasn't my restaurant, but I was opening it for a friend who's a really good guy, and I wanted to get them set, and then they just kept talking, so I came up and I looked, and I was just amazed at what was going on, and my, you know, everything lined up. You know, sometimes I've been very fortunate in my life to know when doors open and see them, And I think I'm very blessed for that, and I'm very grateful for that, to know that, oh, there's a door open right there. I need to walk through that one, not going there. So I have a good sense about me when that comes. So we're really grateful for that. And then I've been here ever since. Started, you know, opened. Most people know that I, you know, was hired by Rope Swing to open the Preacher's Son, and then opened and ran that for years. And then about 2.5 years ago now, a little bit over, I left Preacher's Son because I felt like I had accomplished what I needed to do for that company. And but it was time for me to be able to really, really branch out. And I've said this a few times, but it's really important, I think, in a chef's career, at some point in time, you know, you define yourself by your actions and what you do. And I really wanted to be able to accomplish all the things that I wanted to do without a filter from someone else. And I didn't feel like I needed the support of anyone else for a while. And I think that's a lot of chefs that have to do that. You grow up in this industry and you constantly are learning and growing according to what other people want you to be and how they want you to be and who they need you to be. And at some point in time, and some people still do it for the rest of their lives because they love that structure. I'm just not that way. And I knew that. And there just came a time where I was like, you know what? All the things that I want to do, the collective things that I've learned, I can't do unless it's mine. And so
it's the professional itch.
Yeah. So I did that. And there's absolutely, you know, no looking back, you know, and there were people that were worried, and that's fine. And, you know, but I believed in this community and the support that they would give us and what we were doing, it being, you know, 100% gluten free and supporting the farmers. And I, you know, really wanted to create, we really wanted to create a sustainable model for a restaurant that could provide careers with people, for people in the industry, and offer healthcare and do all those things. And, you know, knock on wood, you know, we've had all the support from the community. We've been able to do that. We, you know, after 6 months, we offered full coverage healthcare for all of our full-time employees. You know, we offer paid vacation for all of our employees, including our servers. Like, we're really trying to show, like, hey, listen, like, you know, it can't, obviously money is involved, but I can't emphasize enough that, and we are in a very unique environment in Northwest Arkansas, obviously. Yep. And why not take advantage of the fact that, in a good way, the fact that we are trying to push a narrative that can exist. And it should exist. I grew up in kitchens where no one got paid good. People got screamed at all the time, you know, and it definitely molded me into who I am today. I just kind of ran the other way. And instead of turning into what I was trained under, I chose to kind of run the other way. But, you know, I was always that way anyway. I just have always been able to, you know, put my head down and take that direction.
It's the learning experience.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the most valuable learning experience you have, is things that you don't want to do and things that you don't want to follow because you see it in person.
Yeah.
So speaking of that, along the way, maybe in the Pacific Northwest, maybe elsewhere, some things you learned along the way from mentors that really grabbed onto you that you do today, and or maybe a really, really good story about a mentor.
Yeah. So this is where I'm going to differ from a lot of people. Not to say that I didn't learn things from the people that I worked for. I did work for some really talented people, and I learned some techniques. But I will say that at some point in time, I realized how I wanted to do things, and I did it. And I even fought my chefs back in the day on how I did it. You know, I had chefs that were like, you know, turn the heat down, you know, cook it slower, do this. And, you know, I did that, but at some point in time I said, look, if I can get the exact same product that you want me to get by cooking the way I want to, can I do it? And they were like, yeah, but you mess up once and it's over. And I'm like, okay, well, I just won't then. When I said that we are who we trained under, that mentality is good and bad, right? Like, because you can take all of the bad things that you learn from those people and you can implement them and use them and continue that cycle of trauma. I use a lot of psychological terms. My wife's a therapist, and I'm very grateful for that.
Mine's an elementary school teacher, so I'm in the corner
a lot.
It's
the same thing. Yeah, they're the same thing. But I would say that, you know, honestly, my entire career, I learned how not to treat people and how not to do things versus how to do things. all the techniques that I learned from people, I did learn good techniques and things like that. And I'm not saying I didn't train under some widely talented people, but, or and, I'm learning that. And it gave me the opportunity to see a perspective to where I always had a focus on saying, I'm never going to do that.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be this way, or it can't be this way. It can't like have to be this way to get it. And we have a lot of internal dialogue in our restaurant and with my management staff and stuff like that about how, like, how do we get the maximum productivity out of our people while being wholly supportive and thinking about not only, like, I really truly believe that you can't be successful and you can't mentor people unless you know what's going on in their lives, unless you know what their families are doing, unless you know who their families are, because you can't look at a person as this physical object that you can get whatever you want out of unless you understand what motivates them, how they need to be motivated, and things like that. You have to treat everyone in this world completely equally while affecting them differently and interacting with them differently, because people learn in different ways. You know, like, I can't learn anything by reading a book ever. Like, it doesn't, it just goes, I'm ADHD to the max. It goes in one ear and out the other. You have to show me, and then I have to implement it, and then everything comes intuitively after that. And so you can't just say, like, oh, I showed you this, you have to do it. Like, everyone learns differently. Everyone is different. And I think, if anything, over the last, thank goodness, however many years, people are learning that everyone's different, and those are our strengths, and those are how we motivate and encourage people to do better and do it. But that presents its own unique problem, right? When you have this open environment where it's, you know, like I always say, we give people an amazing environment in which to successfully fail, right? It's, and I say, look, you're going to fail. I don't care how you fail. It's how you recover from that failure that matters to me, not to do it. Now, after some point in time, you keep failing, and then we have to have a conversation, you know, about like what really, you know, maybe you don't need to do this, or maybe you don't need to do that. Luckily, you know, the people who are attracted to this industry have an innate and inherent like draw, and it does, for the most part, just work. You have few that come here in and out and stuff like that. And we're not perfect by any means. You know, it's like we have to have hard conversations with people just like everyone else. And sometimes people do need to, you know, people too need to go. But it's always, the thought is always with the intention of why and if it's best for that person, as well as being best for the restaurant and the company. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we try to make that in the forefront of our conversation all the time. And yeah. Sorry.
No, you're good. You said earlier, 30% chef, 70% community.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, I think that's just the way that I was raised.
Yeah.
Like, I am not the most widely creative human in the world. I think I'm also not good at talking good about myself. But if I were to say something and be proud of something, I'm proud of the fact that I try my best to understand humans and to be able to nurture them and grow them in the way in which they need to be grown and nurtured. Like, and that's, you know, and that's kind of part of our ethos as well. We always tell, so, you know, we support farmers in the way they want and need to be supported, right? And that sounds very simple. It's not. That is not easy to do. Just like it's not easy to do that with individual humans while treating everyone equally and the same, right? Because some people might need more nurturing or care or attention or training than others, right? But the same level of equality has to exist within everything. So I think the humanitarian approach to it is like, how do we do what we want to do and never stray away from that? And people are like, well, what if it doesn't work? What if prices get too high? What if you don't get the support from the farmers? Then, you know, we won't be here.
Yeah.
Because I'm not gonna do the thing that so many people have done and continue to do it just to hang on, right? Like, that's not why I left a good job where I made a good living and, you know, to do this thing. Like, it wouldn't make sense, right? To dilute it like that. So continuing to pour our hearts in the community, and that conversation is everything. It's like everything that we do, whether it's a menu item or it's things like that, for the most part, you know, we have to always think about money and making sure that there's a roof over our heads and we all have, you know, or we're safe and secure. But, you know, we think about like how we can be a part of this community, how we can benefit the community to help it learn and grow. There's advantages to that as well, because your name gets out there. People hear about who you are. They come check you out, you know, and things like that. But it's just kind of what we want to do. So we do try to do as many things as we can. Like, I don't have business cards anymore because my partner took them away from me. You can't do anything more things. she's like, you can't do it. Nope. So she handles that and she takes care of it for me, and I'm blessed for her. Yes, because yes, I will just say yes to everything. But I don't anymore, so don't worry about it.
All good.
But yeah, so it's a part of just thinking that mentality of like, how does this benefit not only ourselves and the restaurant, but can it benefit the community as well? Whether we do Theater Squared's event every year and collaborate and finding ways to do that to where it's manageable for us while still keeping the restaurant open, to doing being a chef advocate for the global organization CARE and traveling around. I work with some amazing people doing that, working on food and hunger awareness. I worked with No Kid Hungry back in the day, and still look forward to doing more things with Share Our Strength and things like that. And you know, it's just about finding the time to be able to do and pour your energy into those things, and like managing the time and what that energy takes while also, you know, being a husband and having a family and
yeah.
a kid in college and keeping 40 people's, you know, lives on track, because I do believe as a mentor and a person that chose to bring all these people into my lives. It's the only time I'll say my lives. It's like, I do believe we have an obligation to make sure that the people that work with us are taken care of.
And fit in sleep.
Yes. And fit in sleep. I sleep very well.
Good.
Now. Yes.
Good. You leave Preacher's Son. And you're ready to do this. What was the hardest thing about getting this open, about having your space, putting it together, getting it open, opening the doors?
Man, that's another thing. Like, it's not that. So I think the hardest thing, and this is going to kind of be probably different than what people think, the hardest thing about getting this open was, you know, everything takes sacrifice, right? So I wanted to make sure that I was the only owner in this restaurant. And to do that, I had to make some sacrifices. So I cooked privately, for some people for a while, and they were amazing and still are. And I took a job to go and cook in Sagaponack and cook for an amazing family there for an entire summer.
Where's this?
Sagaponack in the Hamptons.
Oh.
So in Southampton's in Sagaponack, and I cooked for an amazing family there, and stayed there, and that helped me kind of give me the time and space it did so many things. One, they were just amazing humans. I kind of vetted them and they vetted me, because it's something very different than what I had done before. But it paved the way for me to, like, every day there, it was like lunch and dinner, right? And they had really nice chefs before, and they had a lot of connections with a lot of amazing people. And I saw, you know, I worked my butt off. I mean, harder than I had, and I lived with them too, so you're never really off work, but right. Luckily we very quickly became like a family, and so things that I normally do for my family, I just did for them, and that was fine. But the hardest part about it was being away from my family.
Sure.
My wife and my daughter, she was about to graduate high school, you know, and I had, you know, my daughter was born when I was 25 years old, and, you know, I worked 17, 18 hours a day as a chef until she was, I think, probably 15. You know, and that's about when I left Preacher's Son. And that was a big defining moment. It was like, I'm going to miss everything if I don't stop.
Yeah.
and do something differently to where I have control of what my schedule looks like. And, you know, and that's just about my values. It's like, I missed it all, man. And I only got one, and she was my world. And so to do that and realize that I had to take another 3 months and just be away completely, that was the hardest thing. You know, it wasn't the struggles. Like I said, like a door opened a long time before I wanted to leave Preacher's. And I just was like, I see it. It's there if I want it. And I chose when to walk through the door. And I think that's really important for people to realize. Not that I think everyone has doors that open for them. And I think it's recognizing when to walk through them and what not. You know, I've had plenty of bad doors open, and I knew that it could be good, but something else might be sacrificed. And I think that's the hardest thing, is knowing when to walk through the right doors.
Absolutely. I'll tell you what, when we come back, let's talk a little bit about those farmers.
Okay.
Let's talk a little bit about menu. We'll talk food, and we'll talk so much more. That's okay. Next on the Flavors of Northwest Arkansas. So this week we are starting the Mike Engelman Home Pro Tip of the Week. My dad lives in Dallas, knows nothing about food and drink up here. And when he was listening to the podcast for the first time, he said, I don't know these people. I don't know these restaurants. These folks have to give a tip that I can use here. So it's called the Mike Engelman Home Pro Tip of the Week. My dad's Mike, obviously. And when he went through this, telling me, I knew a criticism was going to come, and it wasn't, and it made sense, and I loved it, and it kind of made me mad. Anyway, what is your home pro tip of the week for people that, you know, are cooking at home, and it would save them some time and maybe not make them so frustrated as we all get?
I would say that the pro tip would be keep it simple and give yourself grace.
Keep it simple and give yourself grace.
Yeah, which means, you know, don't try to overcomplicate it. Don't try to attack something that you're not technically ready to do. Like, start out slow. If you know nothing, then start out with knife skills. Watch a video on how to, like, cut something up. Because if you're comfortable with a knife, then you feel more comfortable and more energetic and excited about cooking. And then things just build. Things build from there naturally and organically. Like, the more confident you become, the more you feel like you can try something new, and then you develop one thing, like you figure out that spices bloom in oil or liquid instead of just throwing them in dry, you know, like, and things like that. Like, all those little, keep it simple, start from the beginning, build upon, and you'll find yourself cooking like crazy in no time and feeling really confident and creative about it.
My 84, he's going to be 85, I think, when this comes out, maybe, depending on when it comes out. Dad, be careful on the knife skills. We'll be right back.
As an organ donor, your story doesn't have to end. The good in you can live on. In fact, you could save up to 8 lives and restore sight and health for many more. Sign up right now online as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. You'll be happy you did. And just maybe, someone else will be happy too. Go to organdonor.gov. It saves lives. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.
Welcome back to the Flavors of Northwest Arkansas. Guys, please, I know you, I know sometimes you like to speed through the breaks. Please donate. I say it every week. I know you're tired of hearing from me about it, but I'm going to keep saying it every week. Please be an organ donor. I go on tangents about this every week, so I'm not going to go on as much of a tangent here. Just please listen to what I'm saying. Make somebody's life. And we are back. We're back with Matthew Cooper here in Conifer in Bentonville. And you mentioned something earlier about the farmers and the relationship with the farmers and trying to really benefit the farmers, and in turn have them obviously benefit you. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Right. So, when, again, it goes back to this kind of this community building like aspect. As amazing as Northwest Arkansas is, we have this beautiful farmers market that where all these farmers go, and you can just walk
Absolutely.
Around and get pretty much everything you want. It's an amazing farmers market. On the restaurant side of things, it's really hard for us to get a lot of those things for a lot of different reasons. Some are, and a lot of them are systematic, and it's a hard conversation to kind of pull around. So we always do say yes, that we want to support the farmers in the way in which they need and want to be supported. For instance, if some of our farmers that we have worked with in the past, they sell most of their stuff at the farmers market. They make a lot more money selling at the farmers market. They don't need us to buy their stuff. So where I would love to have some of their amazing things, they make more money and support their families better off selling out every single time in the farmers market. So we started off trying to use as many people as we want. We've kind of narrowed it down to the people that really, like, it benefits them and us to give them our business, right? And then we are constantly trying to grow, and as we grow, do that more with more farmers. But we do have our core select people that, like, we're dedicated to. I am a relationship person. I believe in that. I believe in, you know, dedicating yourself to people and having that relationship grow and nourish for many different reasons. It's mutually beneficial in business because they know what they can plant, and they know that we're going to buy it all, and they can guarantee that. So then they can kind of plan their year out, just like people like to plan their schedules and their bank accounts and all those fun things like that. But, you know, we really try to support them. For instance, the easiest way to say this is, so we'll talk about Bansley Farms, which is a pork a pork farmer here in Northwest Arkansas. And they're amazing humans. And we, in some of the other restaurants I've worked here, I haven't been able to use them because the different products, like you have to know your clientele and what they want as well. So, and that's a whole different conversation. But so what we've done with them as far as and as well as Hannah Farms, who does local lamb here, and I've worked with them since even before Preachers, or right around then, is we always go to them and we say, like, what do you need us to use, right? Because there's only a select amount of animals that they're harvesting, however long, and certain people only want certain cuts, you know, and that's the biggest thing. Like with Hannah's, it's most people always want the racks. Some people might want shanks, you know, and then pretty much everything else they don't want. Like no one wants, and we don't have the capacity to do whole animal butchery here, nor with the amount of people that we feed every single night. Do I even have the labor or the means in which to do that? To bring like, oh, well, just give me 8 lambs, right? You know, and I'll break them down and I'll figure it out. No, it just wouldn't work. So no. We have to systematically think about how we can put something on the menu, even if we change it all the time, to where it benefits them and not just us. So primarily, we order all their ground lamb that also has a lot of the beautiful, amazing cuts that no one else normally uses, because only the racks and the shanks go to this, and we get everything else that would not normally be in, quote, what you would think a ground product would be in, you know. So we rotate and we use that, and you know, our goal is to run them out of ground. So they're a sustainable business. They're at blank zero, and they're like, man, we got to take animals, like, because we're out of everything. Versus, you know, I think when we started the conversation, we started off doing the same thing. We're like, oh, we want all your racks, you know, because people love racks, and we want that. And oh, we'll burn through all your shanks. And you know, we were with our team here. We were like, you know, they're like, man, we got like 500, you know, 1,000 pounds of ground meat. Like, can you do anything with that? And we're like, I don't, you know, you think of your clientele and you think about like what people want, and you're like, oh, I couldn't. And we were just like, you know what? We're gonna do it. And so we just put like lamb meatballs on the menu. It's the same cuts. It's the same time and energy that went into raising those racks, that took into those amazing cuts that they ground up. Like, we're not processing it for the most part. And so, you know, we put lamb meatballs on the menu, and then we creative, and it sells better than anything else. And so
awesome.
We have to rewrite what our expectations of what our clientele want. And then honestly, it comes down to like, here's the options that we have. We're doing the best that we can, and we're trying to support everyone in the way in which we want to, while also being creative. And we hope you understand this vision. And luckily, people have been really receptive to that and things like that. So, I mean, we had a barbecue meatloaf on the menu for a while, lamb meatloaf, and then we do lamb meatballs, and then we'll mix it up and we'll do a lamb bolognese or something like that. And as the seasons, we found that as the seasons change, we can 100% use that product and charge what we need to charge for it, to make what we need to make, and so the farmers make what they need to make, and that way this amazing cycle continues on. And the same thing with Banzies. We talk with them about, you know, I talk with Carol and Scott about what, you know, what they need us to order, you know. And it's right now it's like, well, we need to order whole loins, or we need to do this, and we just pivot, you know. And then sometimes we get steak, because there's not a lot of local steak here, and the amount, and that's the real problem, like, in where I see as a problem, because it's such a big animal. Like, how do you do it? Like, people love ribeyes here, people love, you know, strips here, filet or something like that. But like 9 times out of 10, like if I put that on my menu as it is, and we do run specials when local farms harvest and stuff like that, we'll bring some in. But that's why typically we don't have steak on the menu too much, unless it's something like tri-tip, which a lot of people have, like a lot of local farmers have, and no one else orders. So we'll do that. And then when we run out, steak just comes off the menu. And if he's got something, he's like, hey, man, I got, you know, 2 or 3 ribeyes that we need to sell. Like, would you like those? And I'm like, yeah, because that benefits him, right? And I'm like, because I can't do 2 ground products. Can't do ground pork and ground lamb and ground beef. Like, can't just do everything. But so that's kind of a really good example of how we try to support our local farmers by ordering what they need us to. And that translates to produce as well, right? Like, in the middle of the winter, we didn't have a lot of stuff growing, so we do focus on a lot of meat, which we normally have a variety of local. If you grow local meat here and you're one of our partners, where it's on the menu. Like right now, we have chicken off the menu because we use one chicken farmer for the most part. It's Spencer at Across the Creek Farms. If he doesn't have chicken, we don't have chicken on the menu. But if we do, we're using the whole product. he is so successful with what he does and his sustainability model, because he grows all of his own, he orders all of his own grain, he mills all of his own grain, and then feeds it to his chickens, and he owns his processing facility.
It's crazy.
So it's a full circle thing, and it's amazing what he does, and his product is just unrivaled. And there's just not, so I've been working with him for years, so if he doesn't have chicken, 9 times out of 10 we don't have chicken, you know, and because it just doesn't, it doesn't fit what we want to do. So, and people always want chicken, and I'm like, I'm sorry, but he's out of chicken. And yeah, we get more, and we order it, you know, we order it the best way we can. We just order whole chicken. And so you'll see a seasonal rotational half chicken, because we can get 100% utilization, because we have to look at our cost, 100% utilization of the product that we can get from him, while also ordering what he needs us to order, instead of saying, oh, we just want thighs or we just want breasts. And then what happens? Like, we had organically, we had a chicken meatballs on the menu at Preacher's and here, because the same thing happened with him, where it was like, everybody wanted just all the chicken breasts and stuff like that. Well, I mean, like, it takes, right, a lot of money to do, especially what he does and grow and raise chickens the way he does. Mm-hmm. And no one wants to order like the legs or anything like that. And mm-hmm. so, you know, we worked through those problems, and like, well, the chicken meatball was born, and it became like one of the biggest selling things. I mean, people still ask for it, and every once in a while I'll do it. But like, he, because of that, people in the farmer's market buy him out of all his ground.
That's crazy.
Because we kind of started this thing where like people were like, oh, they didn't view chicken as, oh, you can use chicken. It's lean, it's healthy, it's flavorful. He puts all of the fat into the chicken meatball as well. So it's like, it's completely different than, do you know what I mean? So yeah, like all those different things go into it. So what became and started as a necessity for his business model became one of his high, you know, one of his most sold items. And so now it's like, you know, now it's easier for him to have that conversation. We don't have to buy ground from him anymore. Even if I wanted to, he's like, dude, I don't have any. I was like, that's great. I was like, just bring me the whole chickens, you know? And he's like, I'm going to be out in whenever. So, you know, and then with produce, it's the same way. You know, we had a dish on the menu, and it gets harder in the wintertime because mostly root vegetables grow, and people do love our beets, so we can burn through beets, which is great. But like radishes, turnips, rutabagas, you know, things like that. Like, it's, people just don't really have a palate. I mean, like a pound of radishes will last, you know, weeks. You know, if you're shaving them onto something, and
right,
you know, we don't have a lot of people that love salads here in the traditional form of salads. So, so we did like a root vegetable. We roasted radish, roasted turnips, roasted rutabagas. Did a mushroom demi-glace with that, and made it. You know, it tasted like beef stew. You know, with like cream parsnip and stuff like that. And that, again, that's our job. Is like, how can we burn through these things? Because we literally had people saying, "Look, we'll just bring them to you." You know, and that's a problem too. Like, people are growing things that people don't buy.
Right.
Right? Because they have to grow that. So, you know, we've got some pretty exciting things coming in the future with the restaurant that has been our vision for a really long time, where we will have our own farm soon. And that's not to compete with anybody. That's to fit an ever-needing format or performance for people, for us to be able to grow things, long things like carrots, onions, celery, things that we can't get here that are the basis for all of our recipes and things like that, while also growing some really fun things for some friends of ours and to supply both restaurants. It's about pushing our sustainability model. It doesn't mean that we're not going to order everything we've always ordered from our friends, but it's to help that conversation, right? And funnel education through it and things like that. So we're really excited about that. That's coming up pretty soon.
Is that breaking news?
That's breaking news.
Goodness.
Yeah. Some people know that we've been working towards that for a really long time, but I think it's the evolution of the restaurant, and it's the evolution of what we want to do in this community, and to be able to have that more of that sustainability model again. I'm a control person. I want control of everything.
I get it.
So we're fighting for that in any way we can. But again, still fitting a need, not to compete, not trying to compete with anybody that like needs us to use their products. It's just, it's another outlet for us all to like work together. Like in Oregon, like the what makes Pinot Noir in Oregon so amazing is that the coalition of growers that grow Pinot Noir like really believe in what and how they're growing that Pinot Noir, and they all collectively work together. If one vineyard is having an issue with moisture or mold or any of those scientific things that I can't remember to pronounce right now,
sure,
they all work together to help each other, and they make it. And that's kind of that model that we're really trying to do. We're just trying to tag on and help and further encourage this community and atmosphere that Northwest Arkansas already thrives upon.
That's great. That's amazing. One last question, because I know your time is exceptionally valuable, and we've been at this for a minute or two. But gluten-free menu. Tell me a little bit about that and how hard it is to be able to continue to keep a menu that's gluten-free.
It's easy because it never comes in the door.
There you have it.
I still think that most people don't realize this. So I have celiac disease. I'm classically trained, and I even worked for chefs that knew that I had celiac disease, and they were like, well, if you want to work here, you're going to try everything, and you just deal with it, you know? And that's not really the way it works. It's like swallowing concrete. It's or poison or rat, you know, it's not going to kill you, but it will over time. When that was the most amazing thing about when I moved from my restaurant in Little Rock, and to speak to the generosity and the open-mindedness or vision that the people that I used to work for had, I told them if I wanted to move up here, it had to be a gluten-free restaurant. I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't do it for my health. And they didn't blink an eye. And I really do, and I do talk about that a lot. I think it speaks vision worlds to the vision of what Northwest Arkansas like really is trying to accomplish. I think we have a long way to go. But we're trying to accomplish that, right? So in the restaurant, it's really easy. We're always constantly having this conversation. Like, well, wheat doesn't ever come in here, so we don't have to worry about it. I've been cooking gluten-free for a very long time. So it's more about how do we make the biscuit taste like a biscuit? And the answer is, what we found out is it's difficult. It takes more energy, but it just means us tracing things back to their root and where they come from. For instance, using ancient grains from like ants and mills, like going to the direct source. Like a lot of the things that we use in the restaurant are from ants and mills, and they're milling our grains when we order them and shipping them to us, right? So the freshness of those things, the fact that we have to keep our grains in the cooler and the freezer so they don't mold. Like when it's like last time you bought rice at the store, where does it stay? It doesn't stay in the refrigerator.
No,
it doesn't. No. So I'm just saying, and my mother, and like I said, my mother and her side of the family were all food technologists. So like anybody that puts anything in one of those boxes or bags that you buy at the store, a food technologist came up with everything and why it goes in there and all the parts per million of insect parts and all the things that are allowed to be in there. So we just try to trace and we do the best we can. Again, not saying we do that with everything, but we try to trace as best we can where everything is coming from. So it's just the hardest part about being gluten-free is we only use one major food vendor, and it's Benny Keith, and I'm not plugging them, I'm just saying I've worked with them for so long that my guy, and he's a district manager, Raymond, he knows that if I order anything different, he has to call the company. Instead of just clicking the arrow to order it to send to us, he has to call the company, because even if I order, quote, rice, which I order rice from local people, but if I ordered rice, it could have been shared on the same equipment as wheat. And it doesn't have to, by FDA, it doesn't have to say that if it's wholesale sometimes. So it should, but it doesn't have to.
Huh.
That's why I was really sick yesterday, because I my mother-in-law bought a bag of chips and I looked on the back, wasn't there. Doesn't have to claim it, because you don't have to claim it. And I didn't see it, and I was like, oh, that's great. I took two chips the next morning. I was just, oh my God. So you just got to be careful.
Jeez.
I'm like, and I know better than that now, because regulations are constantly changing about what you're allowed to put on it. For instance, like if you see, it just makes it harder for us to do our job, because we have to know where everything comes from and know what they're doing at the facilities in which they are packaging if we're ordering those products. And that's hardest part about the job. Like from a creative standpoint, it's more about like trying to figure out how we can be creative within that. But our paradigm doesn't exist that way. It doesn't come in the door, so it's not an ingredient we have to work with.
Right.
So that's less of a problem than just like the uphill battle to be like, nope, we can't have those almonds. So, well, almonds are gluten-free. I was like, but it says on the box, shared on equipment that shares wheat and barley and rye. And that means for someone like me, one part per million, I am extremely sick. Or to other people that have it even worse than me, like I'm the 0.01% that can't even drink distilled spirits from wheat, like whiskey or anything like that, which means I just don't drink anymore, because what's the point? but because I'm Irish, and it's like, that is, nope, we're good. So, you know, because I, you know, I'll do that and I just can't, I don't remember anything. And because it attacks my brain. So there's different varying degrees of those sensitivities and things. And so it makes it, you know, it's challenging, but it's, from a creative standpoint, it's really easy and it's really fun. From a systematic standpoint, that's where we struggle. But the good thing is it just means we have to source our products from better companies that know where they get their products.
Yeah.
Which is huge. Also means our cost goes up.
Yeah.
By about 30 to 40%.
I get that.
Yeah. So that's the downside, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's not that hard.
I did lie. There is one more thing. We have a friend in common, mm-hmm. and he told me to ask you about the knives.
Oh, yeah. So...
There is up on the wall just a row of just elaborate knives, just kitchen chef knives, I guess is the right way to call it.
Yeah. So this the knives that you're referring to on the wall are this kind of speaks to our vision and what we do. But there was a gentleman named Michael Himmer who lived out in the mountains in Oregon, and he made very archaic looking chef's knives. Most of them don't look like chef's knives, out of old Swedish saw steel that they use to cut down trees in Oregon. And if you know anything about how they plant trees in Oregon, it's very sustainable. So if they cut down a tree, they plant like, I think it's something like 500 more. It's crazy. And even back then they had those practices, which is why Oregon is still like absolutely gorgeous. But he took, and he was a very strange and amazing human. And he did everything by hand, so he was an ancient style blacksmith, and we kind of, that's kind of the relationship we did. Like I found out when I lived in Oregon that he made these knives, and he only sold them at farmers markets, and he never charged more than $130 per knife, even if it was a paring knife or a huge knife. Some of those are like 16 inches long. And yeah. So like, that's not like, those are very, very high quality knives. They should not be that price. But that's just what he did. And he didn't really care. And he was kind of awkward like that. And it took me months and months and months to get him to make a knife for me. And once he did, he sent me this like bent knife that was dull and wasn't even what I asked for. And instead of me like being like, dude, I'd ask you to make this knife, you didn't do that. I sharpened it, and then I made use of what I could with it. And I called him and I said, hey, you know, like, it was really dull and this is not that, and I sharpened it, and you know, but it's good, it'll be for this, that's fine, don't worry about it, it's a learning experience. And he was just like, you sharpened it? And I was like, well, yeah, I mean, I'm a chef, I should know how to sharpen a knife. And
sure.
And then we just started talking, and that was his like, oh, this guy didn't just want me, because he had been in some magazine and people had been trying to get him to make all these fancy knives, and he didn't want to do that. He wanted to make a knife where he started pounding out metal, and whatever came from that metal and that energy, that was the knife. And so that we thought that was really beautiful. And the energy that went into that relationship. And then turns out, that's why I have saw all these knives, is he passed away a few years ago, and his widow called me. And I do believe he truly was one of the last ancient like blacksmiths doing that, what he did, all of local wood from Oregon and stuff like that. And she knew that I have a passion for knife making as well. And I don't have a lot of time to do it, but she made sure that I got all of his knife blanks.
That's amazing.
That he had left. And so we put a display of all of the knives up there to remind us that like the people that you know, it might be harder to earn trust and earn trust with people and individuals, but the benefit that comes from energy putting into relationships is real, rewarding beyond belief. And so they're pretty knives up on the wall, but what they mean to me is that the energy put into relationships and investing into people and understanding what motivates them and what will make them happy gives you the best reward you could ever possibly think of.
Which is what life is.
That's right.
Period.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely.
Very
I appreciate
much.
You.
Where can
much.
They find you?
We are at Conifer. Our website is conifer.bentonville.com. You can look at us on Instagram or Facebook at Conifer Bentonville. And then I am Cooper_chef at Instagram. And I think I'm on Facebook as Matthew Cooper. But we are open 7 days a week from 5 to 9, except on Sundays. We do kind of our casual service from 5 to 8 on Sundays. And we're always here.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, we got a little farm stand right next to the restaurant that you can walk in. That's open. It's self-service. That we can. It supports little local farmers and has some organic drinks and stuff like that. And we're going to start some fun things and activation with that as well pretty soon. Again, just to show transparency with some of the products that we carry in the restaurant that you can get right there. Local eggs, everything like that.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. That's actually where I walked in first.
Yeah, everybody walks in that first because the door because the door's open.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it.
Well, I appreciate it again. Thank you so much for your time. And everybody listening, please don't forget, tip your servers. We'll talk
Absolutely.
To you next week. Bye-bye.